You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hey everybody, CJ here. Welcome to episode 206 of the Dangerous History Podcast. And in this episode, I am speaking with Pete Quinones, the artist formerly known as Mance Rayder. He is, of course, the host of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, a great show that I highly recommend if you're not already a listener to it. A show on which, by my count, I think I've been a guest 3 times, so it was nice to have Pete on my show for a change. And today, the main thing we're talking about is a recently released documentary film that Pete was involved with the production of called The Monopoly on Violence. This documentary is a very well-made film that looks into the history of the state as an institution, how it came to be, what it does, all of the problems it creates and exacerbates, and potential solutions and alternatives. This film features commentary from many leading lights in the kind of libertarian anarchist milieu, just to name a few. Tom Woods, David Friedman, Michael Humer, James C. Scott, Bob Murphy, Thaddeus Russell, Stephen Kinsella, Andrew Napolitano, and many, many more. So anyway, I won't waste a bunch more time talking about it. I'm just going to turn you over to my conversation with Pete about the film and just recommend that you all check out themonopolyonviolence.com to find out more. Okay, so Pete, welcome to the Dangerous History Podcast.
It's great to be on, man. I've had you on my show a couple times, and I'm kind of excited to be on yours.
Yeah, it's very cool. I'm trying to remember, is it a total of 3 times I've been on your podcast?
I want to say it's 3 times. I think the last time we were talking about the true story of the Spartans or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds right. Your episode 300.
Yeah.
But today, we want to talk primarily not about your podcast, which everybody should check out and all that, of course, but about a project of yours that just recently came out, I guess, what, like a couple weeks ago, something like that?
June 1st, when the riots were in full swing.
Nice. Yeah, perfect timing. Well, so the film is The Monopoly on Violence. And it's a documentary film. It's a little bit under 2 hours, I think, an hour and 45, something like that. And it really packs a heck of a lot of good information and stuff that you're not likely to catch almost anywhere else in a similar venue. And first off, I just want to say I love the title, The Monopoly on Violence. I think it's so provocative because someone would see that or hear that and go, what in the, you know, unless someone is a political science major or something like that, they probably won't make the connection as to like, what is this? And so it's provocative and will make a lot of people intrigued. I think, did I hear you say on another show somewhere that wasn't the original title for the movie?
The original title of the movie is actually became the title of our production company, Stateless. And we were headed to do but Chris and Robert, my partners at Stateless Productions, were headed to Narcapulco to start in February 2019 to start doing some of the interviews. And we showed up and Thaddeus Russell is there with a crew of that are doing another documentary called Stateless. So once we found out that there was another movie going on with Stateless, and that's not Thaddeus's production. He was brought in to help with the production on some things that Kim Kyland and I can't remember. I can't remember the gentleman's name, and he's been on my show, I believe. but we found out that there was another documentary being called Stateless. So we were like, well, we got to change the title. And we just literally got into a Facebook group chat, and after about 10 minutes just said, all right, Monopoly on Violence. I think it was going to be Monopoly on Force. And then it was like, no, let's make it Monopoly on Violence. I don't remember who like came up with it and put their foot down and said, okay, this is what we're going to do. This one works perfectly. But yeah, once we switched it over to Monopoly on Violence, I think we all realized how much better that was than Stateless, you know, because Stateless really doesn't make a statement, but you know, people are like, oh, I don't know what the hell's going on there. But the Monopoly on Violence has two words in there that people are averse to. So I think that works.
Yeah. And a lot of what the documentary does, at least in the first section in particular, is stuff that people like you and I and the sorts of people that, you know, we follow in the alternative media and have on our podcast and that sort of thing, we all kind of just sort of take for granted and think about all the time, but things that the average, you know, for lack of a better term, the average kind of normie or whatever, muggle, these are thoughts that they just are never exposed to or encouraged to think, like basic things that even mainstream political science scientists wouldn't disagree with, such as, what is the state? Well, it's a monopoly on violence. And just, you know, those powerful things of pointing out the state, just what it is, you know, and then sort of saying, all right, given the fact of what this thing is and what it really does, how could a halfway decent person be on board with this? So I think that's one of the things that the film does very well. And it's very well made from a technical point of view. You know, it's very like the audio and video and editing and all that sort of stuff is very good. But can you tell us, how did you come to be involved with this project?
Well, social media, as much as most I've come to believe that social media is just a sewer. There were a couple local anarchists here in Atlanta that I went to a meetup with them and had dinner with them. And we had never discussed anything, just, hey, you know, every once in a while, get together and hang out. Well, one of them contacted me one day and said, I got a proposal for you. Can we meet for lunch? So, you know, we went out for lunch on a Sunday and everything. And he said, I have this idea for a documentary. And he had already like laid out, done an outline of it and everything. And I was like, well, why me? And he's like, well, you're a podcaster and the people that we want to have in this, you've talked to most of them. So you can talk to them and get them, you know, get them on board with this. So I was like, no, that makes sense. And the first thing that popped into my mind was Mises University. I said, Mises University, we're going to have everyone, you know, half the people we want to interview are going to be there. So we immediately started planning for that. But it took about, I guess from that time we started planning it out, we're looking at about 6 months to the first interview, which was like in Anarchapulco 2019. But I was just approached. I'm sorry, I forgot the question. I tend to do that when I'm sober. I was approached. Chris said, I have this idea for doing a documentary. No one's ever done a documentary where, you know, you're actually talking about anarcho-capitalism. But he said, but also we're going to talk about all faces of anarchism. So we're going to present everyone that, you know, we talk about Stirner, you know, egoist individual anarchism. And we talk about Proudhon and Kropotkin, you know, hard left anarchism. And then we bring it up to Rothbard and we concentrate more on anarcho-capitalism than anything else. But yeah, I mean, I was just basically brought in because I could get these people. I could talk to these people about being interviewed. And sorry, I keep wanting to go off and just talk about the documentary because I love it so much. But
we're going to dig into all sorts of aspects of it for sure.
Yeah.
Your like quote unquote official role as far as the production goes was it executive producer? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, I'm executive producer. I'm one of the producers, writer, and yeah, those are really the three things. And then when it came, I mean, I didn't physically edit it, but, you know, I got sent, it was 3 hours long before we edited it down. So I said, you know, I said, we got to take this out. We got to take this out. There was a section in there where which just seemed a little self-indulgent. I said, take that out and everything. So, you know, this was way more about wanting this to be the best thing possible and to be the best product we could put out there than any kind of self-indulgence or anything. That's why you only see me in it twice.
Yeah. And I think it's the sort of thing that anyone could refer someone to who is not already some sort of anarchist or libertarian or whatever, but who is already, you know, somewhat well-read, like maybe knows a little bit of basics about things like political science and history and economics, but, you know, not an expert. Someone who's maybe read a few books and is not completely illiterate on those things, but who's open-minded, who, you know, is really encountering some of these ideas for the first time. I think it's a great, like, one-stop shop that maybe people are, not maybe, I can guarantee, people are would be more likely to look at, watch a nice, well-made film than if you're like, here, read this 600-page book by Rothbard or whatever like that. I think it's a nice introduction, but that still has a lot of depth to it. And, you know, it packs a lot into, and like you already said, you know, I'm sure you had way more stuff that didn't make it into the final cut. But, you know, my hat's off to you for what you all were able to pack into a film that still comes in under 2 hours.
Oh, we appreciate it. That was, it was a lot of work. And I really have to give Chris Kofer, who, you know, he gets the directing and the editing credits on it. He was the one who decided how it was going to be laid out, what subjects we were going to, how one subject was going to go into the next and how it was going to flow. And he did that. And then he'd send it to me and I'd be like, all right, we need to cut this out. And every time I did it, I'm like, oh, cutting parts of his baby apart and everything, you know? So, but, he was okay with pretty much every cut that I suggested except one. And he won on that because he, you know, in the last 3 months before we released this, I mean, this was night and day for him. So, yeah, he's like, I have to take director's privilege on this one.
Well, can you give us like just the big picture sort of broad brush view of what were you guys trying to accomplish with the film, and then also sort of link to how it's organized, how it's laid out, and kind of like the narrative that you're trying to put together overall in big picture terms?
Yeah, we wanted to present anarchism to the public. We wanted to make a documentary that somebody could share with a normie friend of theirs and it would make sense. That was our goal. Our goal was when people think of anarchism, they think of somebody with a hammer breaking windows on an auto zone in Minneapolis. I mean, that's pretty much what the public thinks. And we wanted to change that perception. So the way it's laid out is three parts. The first part is just the history of the states. We wanted to show exactly the states that we have now, exactly how young that concept is, and to show how they operate. And they operate as a monopoly. And monopolies, especially monopolies that don't have that, as Jeff Dice says right in the first 10 minutes of it, that are the judges of their own criminality. So if they do something criminal, they don't answer to somebody else. They answer to themselves, which is horrible. We see the old meme about the police investigated themselves and found they did nothing wrong. Well, I mean, that's government. So the first part, we wanted to lay out what the state is, what they do. The second part, we really wanted to nail that down of, yeah, this is just, this can't stand. It's not a civilization. People talk about how, you know, we live in a society, we live in a civilization, taxes are the prices we pay to live in a civilized society. Well, you got over 2 million people in jail and, you know, over half of them are in there for nonviolent crimes. So how is that civilization? How is civilization somebody who's handcuffed laying on the ground and helpless, being held down by two cops. A third one drops their knee into their neck until they can't breathe anymore. How is this civilization? And then the most important part is, what are the solutions? How can we make a better way? We have to be able to show people, after we've completely decimated any argument for the state even existing, as Robert Higgs says, the state is too dangerous to exist. What are the solutions? What are the solutions to welfare? What are the solutions to security? What are the solutions to national defense? And one of the things we really wanted to do was to really make an argument for the free market, that the free market can solve any of these issues. And I think we did a good job of it. One of the things, I guess one of the criticisms that we've had so far is that there's just too much in there, that for an hour and 45 minutes and somebody watching it who really isn't that familiar with our, you know, what we believe, that there may be too much. And what I would say is that I think that we put enough things in there that would become brainworms, that would be like, get somebody thinking about one specific thing and they go away with that, whether it be Max Borders talking about panarchy, or talking about alternative, Peter Klein and Mark Thornton talking about alternatives to education. I think that we really did a good job of addressing problems that every normie knows exists, and giving a solution to it, so that if people don't get the big picture of what we're talking about, they can walk away with asking questions about something that would be, that they would see as a self-interest of their own. And hopefully they would go away and start investigating that more, just like I did. I mean, I became a libertarian. I became an anarchist because of money, because I understood what the Fed was doing. And that just led me down a path. So, and as I really think with an hour and 45 minute documentary on anarchism, that's all we can hope. And I mean, I've heard stories of people who've already shared it with normie friends, and they're reading anarcho-capitalist literature or reading Anatomy of the State. And that's fantastic. But we also understand it's not going to be everybody. So I just wanted to put something out there to pique people, at least have one or two things in there that pique their interest, and hopefully they go away investigating it.
Yeah. And there's always the possibility of, I guess you could use a couple different metaphors. The planting the seed would be one. Another would be the time bomb, right? Where you're planting a mental time bomb in somebody of maybe cognitive dissonance or something like this. You know, sometimes, and I'm sure this has happened to you plenty of times, it's happened to me plenty of times in my intellectual development, sometimes somebody will say something, express an idea or a point of view, or point out, you know, an issue or a contradiction to me. And at the time, I'm just like, this person is obviously wrong, or obviously crazy, or has some ulterior motive, or is whatever. And sometimes it'll be months or even years later that I'll suddenly go, something else will click, and, you know, something else will happen, or I'll be exposed to some other information. And I'll go, oh, that person that I thought was a complete crazy or idiot or whatever, they were completely right. And I was the dummy for taking however long it took to realize that they were right. So, you know, there's always the possibility of that.
I have personal experience in this recently. Is, I mean, I read Konkin years ago, you know, Agorist Primer, New Libertarian Manifesto. And it wasn't until the last 6 months that I see it as the most important readings that I've ever done as a libertarian. And yeah, that's just, hey, I read those books years ago. I've been an agorist for going on 12 years now. And why haven't I been promoting it? And it's like, why haven't I been wholeheartedly embracing it and talking about it? And it's really only been probably 3 or 4 months now, really since COVID started, that, yeah, it was just something that was put into my brain, you know, 5, 6 years ago. And now it's just like, boom, it's like, holy crap, that's the answer. That to me at this point in time, that I see that as the answer to everything that's happening. So yeah, I mean, it's from personal experience.
Yeah. Well, in the film, you've got a really impressive lineup of commentators. And obviously, you know, much of that is thanks to your contacts from all your podcasting and all the work you've done related to that. But just for the listeners who haven't yet had a chance to look at the film or anything like that, or haven't yet heard you talk about it on other podcasts, I mean, just to name a few, we've got Tom Woods, we've got Thaddeus Russell, we've got Judge Napolitano, we've got a lot of the economists who are, you know, associated with the Mises Institute, people like Mark Thornton, who's been on this. Actually, I was trying to count how many of the people in the film have been on my podcast as well. And I don't do, you know, a huge amount of guest episodes, but, you know, I've Scott Horton is in there. He's been on my show. Thaddeus Russell was on my show a while ago. I had Mark Thornton on once a year or two ago. I forget exactly when, but anyway, just a great rundown. Even got Ron Paul on there, Bob Murphy, Dave Smith, and then some people who are maybe a little bit outside of that kind of, you know, Ron Paul / Mises circle, but who nonetheless I think are really interesting and important and underknown in those circles, even though they're a little bit different. They're not quite, you know, the typical, if there is such a thing, the typical kind of Austrian economics anarcho-capitalists like James C. Scott or Michael Humer, both of whom I really appreciated their contributions to the documentary in particular. I've been a big fan of both James C. Scott and Michael Humer for a long time, ever since I came across, you know, their writings and stuff, probably around the time I started my podcast. So we're talking like 6 years ago or something like that, that I was tipped off to both of those guys. So yeah, just a really impressive group of commentators who are not 100% all of them in lockstep with each other on everything, which is good. And who all have, you know, some different areas of emphasis and expertise. And, you know, there's at least another dozen great commentators besides the names I tipped off. Those were just, you know, off the top of my head. So I'm not putting anyone else down who was in the film by leaving them out on purpose. But anyway, yeah, so great job as far as that goes.
Well, yeah, we wanted to have as many voices as possible. Thankfully, one of our co-producers, we brought in three or four other people in to help us on this. Vinnie Marshall, he's a videographer who lives out in San Francisco, and he's the one who was able to save us money for travel, which is, that's when we found out when you're doing a documentary, and especially if you can edit it and do it yourself, the travel was most expensive. He was able to get Thaddeus because Thaddeus is in San Francisco. He was also able to get David Friedman. And that was important to us to get David Friedman in there because he is sort of a not opposite of people from the Mises Institute, but, you know, not down the line with the people from the Mises Institute. So people like that. I think that the president of the Mises Institute, Jeff Deist, is maybe the show stealer in the whole thing, because every time he's on the screen, he is making points that just absolutely destroy anything, any argument about the state being the best option for anything that you would bring up. And I think Ryan McMakin also did a great job. He's the editor at Mises.org. His parts were just fantastic. And yeah, there was just a few of the people who ended up, like, we had not had a okay from Judge Knapp. We hadn't even asked him, but he teaches at Mises University every year. So I just went down to the office that he was using for the week, and I said, we're shooting a documentary. I want to ask you some questions about the founding. And are you cool with that? And he just asked me one question. You know, is there going to be any problem with, is this going to compete with Fox and my contract at Fox? And I said, no. And we got him. And I can't wait to release like the bonus footage of the stuff that we didn't use from him, because there was some great stuff, him talking about the Articles of Confederation and talking about Waco. So yeah, it's just being able to have access to so many people with so many different ideas, not even talking about Stefan Kinsella, who you know, talks about the law and the form, how modern law came into existence and really evolved. And then talking about how international law could be a basis for how anarchy could work at the local level. It's just when I start thinking about everyone who was in it and everything they said, it couldn't have been better. I mean, I know we wrote the questions so that we could guide them and everything, but we couldn't ask for better people to be in it because they really told the story. And I think anyone who watches it notices that my idea it was that there was going to be a whole lot more narration. And when it came down to it and we started looking at what people were saying, we realized we weren't going to have to use an insane amount of narration for this because they're telling the story.
Yeah, it must have been absolute murder figuring out what things to leave on the cutting room floor, given, you know, the quality of all the folks that you had in the film. I mean, I'm sure there must have just been so much great stuff, so many brilliant points that you were like, you know, we can't make this thing 4 hours, guys.
Well, it's also material that we can use for future documentaries. Ah, so
are you already working on something else?
Yeah, we already have the next one planned out, and we're just nailing down the specifics right now of who we want to be in it. We already know who we want to narrate it. I'm not telling anybody that, because if we can get this person to narrate it, it would be pretty huge. But he's going to have to get paid. So, we're going to need more money than we had. We'll need a lot more money than we had for this one, to do the next one. There might be a lot more travel involved, but, I think it's a subject that anyone who's been paying attention for the last 3 or 4 weeks, will be interested in.
Right. Yeah. Oh, is it either Peter Coyote or Keith David? Those are my two favorites, voiceover narrators for like documentaries and things. It's not either of them two, is it?
As far as I know, this person has never actually done a documentary, but he does have a show on Netflix. So I will say that much.
Interesting. Oh, it's Joe Exotic.
That would be epic.
Maybe that's something he can get into now, you know, even from behind bars, he can do voiceover work. So. Well, let's talk about some of the things that you in the documentary take on as far as the myths, the problems, all that sort of thing. You go after some of the things that people like you and I who've been in these sort of circles for a while are, you know, almost kind of tired of hearing about. But of course, to the muggles, this is like brand new stuff that they think no one could possibly have a counter argument to. But let's just take the idea of the sort of related ideas of the social contract and democracy as particularly for like the modern post-French Revolution sort of state, that those two things are often trotted out as, you know, the main legitimizing. Once you get away from the divine right of kings and that sort of stuff, those are often the main legitimizing stories for the modern, you know, like democratic republic state. But in the documentary, obviously, you guys coming from an anarchist perspective go after that pretty hard. So how would you describe sort of the short version of what's wrong with democracy and the social contract and all that?
Well, we knew that we were going to have to take those two on, and their democracy is just thrown around. I mean, it's a word that is almost like racism now, where it's thrown around so much, who knows what it even means anymore. And, you know, the social contract is just absurd on its face when you think about it. Even when I was a statist, I didn't, if you would have told me, oh, there's a social contract where you owe this to me, and I'd be like, get away from me. But we knew we had to have Michael Humer on for both of those, because Michael Humer's book, The Problem of Political Authority, is probably the best book on either subject. And there's no way you can argue for the social contract or democracy after you read it. So going after the social contract, we just had to let Michael talk and let him go over the fact that there's three versions of it and just dismantle each version. And he really does a good job of showing how the argument for the social contract is ridiculous. democracy is the harder one. I argue against a social contract, and I just start throwing out legal terms like, you know, a contract is two ways. You know, if I'm paying into something, I have to be able to get something in return, and I don't even get that, and I can prove it. But democracy is the harder one. And, you know, Michael's just one of those people who breaks it down really easy. And it's so simple to destroy democracy, because democracy is basically majority rule. So, you know, he talks about have five people being in a room and four people decide they're going to beat up the fifth guy. Well, what's wrong with that? If democracy is okay, if majority rule, then what's wrong with that? They don't have authorization in order to do it. Okay, so put uniforms on the four people. So the four people now have uniforms. We call them police officers, and they vote to beat up a fifth guy. Well, then how does that work? I mean, is it good then? It's like, there's also the other argument of if those four people can't vote to beat up or steal from the fifth guy, how do you or I have, how can we legitimately give power to somebody else who's wearing a uniform so that they can do it for us? Well, if we don't have the right to do it, how can we give that right away to somebody else? And those are, you know, the arguments that humor makes. And I mean, I really think it's just the easiest argument against democracy. And people who would argue back and say, well, that's not how it works, I mean, they're just not being honest with themselves. And a lot of that cognitive dissonance has kicked in.
Yeah. So much of it is this, I'm not even sure quite the right word or metaphor to describe it, but this whole idea that just by changing the name of something, you fundamentally change the morality of what's being done. Right. So, you know, if I have a boundary dispute with my neighbor and I decide to solve it by just taking preemptive violence against him, almost anybody would say that that's horrible and immoral and criminal and what have you. But when a president or a prime minister does it to a neighboring state, then it's called foreign policy, right? Or when some guy prints up a counterfeit $20 bill, let's say, that's considered, you know, a crime that apparently even might carry the death penalty these days. But when the Fed does it, it's called monetary policy. And so a lot of this is just like the smoke and mirrors and pageantry and all that, that is, it's designed, it's the magician doing something with one hand that's, you know, very flashy and whatever, while the other hand does the picks your pocket or what have you. And to me, democracy is just, to a large extent, it's almost like a fake magic trick.
I mean, because that guy up there preaching is wearing a robe and he has a fancy costume, he somehow has his words carry more weight than mine. And it's the same thing with a cop. It's like, well, he's wearing a costume. He has a shiny badge. He has a gun, and he took an oath. Well, how is that any different than where did the priest get his authority? How does this person get his authority? That's why I never understand how atheists can be pro-state, because they can see through the illegitimacy of this pageantry over here, but they can't see that, oh, just because this person's wearing some kind of magical suit or something, he somehow is above all of us and, you know, has the ability to kill us and not suffer any consequences for it. It just doesn't add up. It doesn't add up when you look at it. And it is very, very religious. I think it's a religion unto itself. And I find it very hard to argue against that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cult. I mean, I'm someone who personally kind of, I don't know if the right word is became, but sort of realized I was an atheist at a pretty young age as a kid, and much earlier than I, you know, became an anarchist. But I can remember when I was becoming an anarchist that in my own train of thought, my atheism and the way of looking at things that led me to atheism, a lot of which simply had to do with skepticism of authority based on logical fallacies, that I remember saying, well, how on earth could you be an atheist and not be an anarchist? I'm not saying that all anarchists have to be atheists. I've got some affection for like Christian anarchists and whatever, even though I don't believe in their theology, but the idea that one could be an atheist and still be a statist. Yeah. It just strikes me as a case of very, very strong, compartmentalization and just a willingness to have blatant cognitive dissonance going on and just, you know, ignore it. And I think that another subject that you all cover very well in the documentary is the answer to the fact that it seems like most atheists are like hardcore statists simultaneously. The answer, I think, is pretty clearly that it's the quote unquote education system, right? The state provided schooling system, which is another one of those topics that you all have some great coverage on and some great commentary on in the film.
Well, we knew that we needed Thaddeus Russell for that, because there are a lot of people out there who can talk about Prussian schooling, the Prussian schooling system, the Prussian system, the design, where how the American system was just basically mirrored, how it mirrored that. And Thaddeus just lays it out perfectly. But he also, being at graduating from Ivy League, an Ivy League school, and being in academia at all the right schools, all the schools that are considered to be the elites of the elites. And he just abandons that and says that this is just not the way, that this is doing more damage to humans than anything else. So we needed him to talk about that. And I believe his section about 10 minutes in, 12 minutes in, where he's talking about schooling in America is just, I think it just destroys it. If your heart's open to hearing it, I think it just destroys the argument. I could see that his whole section really causing a lot of screeching from people who the public schooling is. There's like three sacraments of the state in the United States, and one is public schooling, one is the military, and the other one is police. So it's like teachers, soldiers, and police, and you're not allowed to criticize any of them. They all have our best intentions at heart and everything. So when you go after public schooling, it's going to be a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people. But I think a great argument he also makes is that even private schools, even homeschooling, that in many states, and you know, especially from Department of Education standpoint, is they want to approve everything. So it's not like, oh, I'm going to homeschool my kid and they want certain things to be taught. Private school is the same thing. I went to private school for high school. I mean, the environment was different. The education and the way they taught it was more conducive to learning, but what they taught was basically the same thing my friends who went to government school were learning. So yeah, Thaddeus just nails it. I mean, I thought that he would be the perfect person for that. And you know, we were lucky enough to nail him down, and he made it happen. I have to give it all to him. He is one of those people who is perfect for a documentary. Speaks well, highly educated, doesn't even have to think about it. It just flows.
Yeah. And he's able to do it in a just such a calm, reasonable way, while saying something that is just so radical. I mean, where he's something that most mainstream people, it would strike them as just insane and crazy to say that schools are basically a form of prison.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah. And, but he's able to say it in, you know, he's not like yelling it through a bullhorn, losing his mind or something like that. He's able to just be like very calm and, you know, reasonable and whatever. And with all the education and credentials in the world behind him. But yeah. Oh, and another thing is totally, totally different topic, but another thing I wanted to make sure to mention is later on in the documentary, where you're kind of looking at some different examples of, you know, anarchism in practice on a small scale and potential solutions to some of these things and what have you. There's that segment where you talk a little bit about that area in Mexico. Can you say a little bit about where was that in Mexico, where they have like a little bit of local anarchy going on, and so far it's going okay?
Well, it's Chiron, Mexico, and they just, in the early 2010s, they got sick of the government, the political parties, and they drove them all out. They just said, you're going to get out of here. They drove the cartels out, and they just walled off the town. And they said, and you have to get permission to go in. And if you're going in there to talk politics or start a political party, they're not going to let you in. So what started out as what seems like very communal living, you know, wouldn't call it anarcho-capitalist. It'd probably be more like anarcho-syndicalist. But as we clearly show in this section that was from a shorter documentary on Chiron that we saw, and we contacted the filmmaker, and he's the one talking in it, speaking English in it. It shows that now they are looking at commerce. They are like, you know, we need to invite companies in here. We need to get business going. And we need commerce. And that's very promising. And I know they had to basically take the Mexican government to court to get their autonomy. And, you know, it sounds like you're begging for your liberty or something like that. But they are an autonomous zone. And you know they're doing good things because you never hear anything bad coming out of there. And the local governments and the Mexican government will tell you, don't go near there. It's anarchy. If you go there, you could get killed. But there's no reports. And there have been a bunch of Americans who've gone down there and done some filming and checked it out and everything. And it's just a peaceful place that has gotten rid of politics, basically, and decided to go to more of a, for lack of a better term, just sort of a clan system, or not even a clan system, but just let's leave us alone. And if we need to have decisions made, we'll come together and we'll figure it out. But people can leave too. So I like the idea a lot. I think it's promising. I won't try to compare it to anything that's going on in Seattle right now, because I think it's completely different and it's too early to tell as far as what's right. going on up there. But everything that's come out of Chiron, I've actually seen. I know Luke Rutkowski's gone into Chiron and says it's awesome, says it's a great place to visit. And I trust his judgment a lot. So, yeah, we wanted to present that and show that we've also learned since then that there's let's call them autonomous zones, because that's what's in the zeitgeist right now. They're all over Europe. So there are options there. And it's something that Ryan McMakin said. He said, the freer we get, if we want freedom, we just have to have a lot of choice. We have to be able to choose what we want. And it's also something that Max Borders talks about in Panarchy, where you can choose what government you want, what form of security you want, things like that. Someone who lives next door to you could be aligned to a different government or security agency than you are. Everything. And it's like, why can't we have that choice? So, yeah, that's what Chiron says to me. And I look forward to learning a lot more about it as more comes out.
Yeah, me too. I'm intrigued. Before watching the film, I was oblivious to this. This was the first time I had even heard of this. So yeah, it was very definitely something I want to look up more about. Well, like me, you've been in kind of, the libertarian anarchist milieu for a while. And so, you've been exposed to tons of libertarian and anarchist ideas and perspectives and all that. But that said, I'm interested to know, was there anything that any of the commentators said or talked about in the film that either maybe surprised you or taught you something new or gave you a new perspective on something, maybe caused you to look a little differently either at the state or at anarchism or anything like that?
Well, I think one that's standing out to a lot of people is, I'll bring his name up again, Max Borders, talking about Panarchy. A lot of people, when they hear the term Panarchy, who've been around the movement for a while, think of, the state dissolves And then, you know, you'll have an anarcho-capitalist city here, and you'll have an ANCOM, an anarcho-communist city over here, an anarcho-syndicalist city over here. But his idea of panarchy is more practical, I think. And I mean, even could exist within the state structure and would seem almost more agorist to me that it would, if people had choice about protection agencies, stuff like that, the state would become obsolete. So Max talking about panarchy, you know, Ryan McMakin just basically talking about choice, like I had mentioned in talking about Charon, is that I know it sounds really simple, but it's not something I'd really considered before, is that the more choices you have, the freer you are. That simple little thing really stuck with me, and it'll be something I won't forget. And just really seeing the passion that people have, the people who are presenting this, the people who we interviewed, they were as excited about it as us. And just being able to see that, yes, that this isn't, oh, I'm going to write books and I'm going to sell books. It's like, no, they have a desire to live in a free world, in a free society, where the state doesn't hold that monopoly on force and violence over people. That was probably the most, what keeps me going is knowing that these are people who work in the system and are out there trying to do, some of them are working in the system in academia and trying to do everything they can to spread the message to young people, but that they're as on fire for having to, for lack of a better phrase, liberty in our lifetime. That's probably what I most took away from all this, is that I'm not the only one who burns to get the state out of my life.
Yeah, that's always a nice thing. It's the same thing that I experience, you know, on maybe a smaller scale, but when I've gone to events like Porkfest or the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest up in Michigan and those sorts of things, where, you know, it is energizing and it is nice to be around cool people who don't think you're crazy for having these different ideas and these out of the mainstream ideas. It's nice to, I can remember, I think it was when I spoke at Porkfest, this was a while ago and my podcast was still only like a year old or something like that. And so I didn't have a huge following, but there were people there who, you know, had followed me or whatever, but I was just having a conversation with somebody I met there about, I can't even remember what it was. I think it might've been either some particular conspiracy theory, like having to do with the Kennedy assassination, or maybe it was having to do with the origins of the Fed, you know, and like Creature from Jekyll Island type stuff. And I'm just having a conversation about these things that like normies would hear you talking about. And in their mind, there's no difference between that and Alex Jones, basically, you know, and some random dude walking by just happened to hear me mention whatever it was we were talking about. And he just jumps right in like, oh yeah, hey, have you read this book? Oh yeah. Yeah. Have you read this one? You know, that sort of, it's just, you know, I'm sure this is how, like, I assume Trekkies or people like that, you know, subcultures, they must have felt before the internet, when it made it easy to connect with every single person around the world that shared your interest or your hobby or your belief system or whatever, when they would actually go to like a little convention or whatever like that, right? Where it's like, whoa, good. I'm not crazy for wanting to wear my Spock ears all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I live an hour and 15 minutes away from the Mises Institute, so I take in as many functions as they have there. And yeah, it's always the same. I just, being around people who think like you, who believe and desire the same thing as you do. I've been to New Hampshire. I haven't been for Porkfest, but I've been for Liberty Forum, and it was very much the same way. So yeah, it is.
Yeah, I haven't been to Liberty Forum. I've been to Porkfest, and then I was at the Free Coast Festival a couple of years ago.
They asked me to speak at Liberty Forum, so I went, and it was a good time. I had a lot of fun. Met some people that I'm still in contact with. So yeah.
Yeah, great folks in Portsmouth for the Free Coast Festival. So if you ever get invited or whatever to go there, it's definitely worth checking out as well. Well, what do you think as far as did you hit the jackpot as far as the timing of when the film dropped? Because it came out June 1st, which, I mean, between the whole coronavirus fiasco and then the economy falling off a cliff and then, you know, the corporate elite getting bailed out yet again, and then all the stuff following the George Floyd incident. I mean, it seems to me your timing couldn't have been better for when this thing came out. What are your thoughts on that?
We had planned to have it out on May 31st, no matter what. We actually released it that day, and we realized that there was somehow the narration cut off at like an hour and 25 minutes in, and it wasn't there for the rest of it. So we had to pull it down and fix it real quick. So we pulled it down and fixed it and put it back up. And then we just announced it. We just started blasting all over social media. Hey, it's out. Go to this link and everything like that. Now, I will be honest. The version that's on YouTube right now, there are some audio issues as far as like some interviews are a little lower than others. We've fixed that because we're getting it ready for Amazon. So we have to fix all the audio problems or else they won't take it. They'll kick it back. So we had someone contact us and say, hey, you know, there are some audio issues as far as leveling and everything. I'm a professional. Put it in Dropbox, get it to me. We'll take care of it. So we're in the process of getting that done. Re-recording just a couple of the narration bits and everything so that we can, you know, everything's going to be perfect when it goes to Amazon. So what's on YouTube isn't perfect. To my ears, it's not perfect. There's only like 10 or 15 people who've actually caught on to the fact that there's some leveling issues there. But we just felt like we had to get it out at that point. June 1st, there's still things on fire in cities. There's hostility towards the police. People are taking over police stations. People are fighting against the police. And we just, you know, the movie poster that we did before all of this even started is the police lined up with shields in front of the White House with a drone in the background, and there's blood on the shields. And that was just, you know, it was like, could we do anything better? The intro, you're not 6 seconds into it and you see a line of police with shields. Well, that was made before all this started. So it was almost like prophetic that it would come out at this time, because that's the reason why we put a version out there that we know needs some tweaks and everything. But I think people just ran to it. There's still, I think, a combination of people still being locked down and, you know, just all the violence that was going on. It just seemed to be friggin' perfect timing, and people wanted to see it. And I think that there's, at times like this, when people are actually questioning state functions, it was just, it couldn't have been more perfect. I mean, it's just, you know, we're you're watching cities burn. And unfortunately, I'm smiling a little bit because I'm like, man, this couldn't have been better timing. You know, it's like, I want all this to stop. Please stop burning stuff down. But here's our documentary on why this is happening and, you know, why the state needs to be abolished. And it's all funny to me right now, although, you know, there are still problems going on out there.
Yeah. Of course, not to celebrate any of the, you know, bad stuff that's happening or whatever, but at least one of the silver linings of disasters like this is that it creates an opportunity for people to, at least a certain percentage of people are going to have their ears open to ideas they normally wouldn't even give a hearing to. Now, this can be bad because, of course, it can also be an opportunity for, I don't know, communists, right, or Nazis or whoever, you know, fill in the blank with bad political ideas that'll make things worse. It also gives them an opportunity too. So it is good to have, you know, some high quality stuff from the good guys out there
I will say that we released it on June 1st. I think we're recording today is the 19th or the 20th. And it has right now 54,612 views on YouTube. So when it was at 20,000, I was texting Thaddeus Russell and I told him that. And he's like, are there even 20,000 ANCAPs, anarcho-capitalists out there? And I'm like, I don't think we're the only ones watching this, dude.
Yeah, no, it's pretty awesome. And especially considering that it's an hour and 45 minute long documentary too. It's like, it's not the same as just like a 10 minute rant that goes viral or something like that. Like it's something that I would assume even someone who maybe doesn't sit through the whole thing, I would imagine most of them are at least sitting through a good chunk of it, because I don't think you would click on a video that's that long, you know, unless you're intending to really give it a fair hearing.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons we are so eager to get it onto Amazon.
Yeah. And then the plan is to go next to Netflix. Is that right?
Yeah. Once you get it on Amazon, drive traffic to it, you know, see all the traffic that's also on YouTube and everything, point that out to people at Netflix, because Amazon is very open about taking documentaries. Cody Wilson did a documentary on printing firearms. Half of it was printing firearms, half of it was Bitcoin, and they took it. So as long as you're not putting anything that's objectionable in there, and it's a quality, they'll accept it. So yeah, we'll have to see. I had someone contact me the other day and tell me they're doing some work on a show on Netflix. So if we submit it to Netflix, we're going to try to keep it on Amazon for like a month and a half so that it can build some momentum, and then submit it to see what the numbers are, submit it to Netflix with that. And then, you know, if there's any kind of pushback or any, if they balk on it and everything, maybe reach out to some people who have some stuff on Netflix now and see if they can help us get it on there.
Very, very cool. Well, I'll link to the YouTube version in the show notes for sure, and urge everybody to check out the film if they're not already part of the awesome 50 whatever thousand who've done so. And
well, the website is important. Okay. It is themonopolyonviolence.com, and what we have on there is a link to the video on YouTube. We have a free 720 download, and we have a 4K download version of it, which is this. The 720 is free, the 4K is $10. Next to the 720p, we also have a donate button where you can donate cash. We also have some cryptocurrency addresses there and everything. So if you want to take it for free and throw us a couple bucks, you know, that would be appreciated. And then we have our merchandise we have movie posters, and there's links on that page to it, and also merchandise. We even have a mask, if people are wearing masks these days. Nice. that have our circular Stateless Productions logo on it. So yeah, so we have all that and everything. One thing I will say is we've made no money on this at all. We're out of pocket on this, and we don't see how we're going to make any money on this, because Netflix does, if they like a documentary, they will offer money for it to pay for it. And, you know, it's not you're not going to get rich, but it is a sizable sums that they're offering for documentaries. But we want to have total control of this. We think it's really important. Nothing like this has been done before. And we know that we're not going to make any money off of this. So if you want to donate, donate. If not, you know, not begging, just letting you know that, when you look at the quality of the production and everything, yeah, this was us doing it out of just, this is a passion project for us. So,
okay. Well, I'll definitely link to the site and encourage everybody to check it out. And anything else, obviously the number one thing we're shoving everybody towards is the documentary, but anything else you want to plug while you're here?
Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. Doing some great episodes recently talking about everything that's going on ever since COVID-19 started and the riots. I've been doing my best to get people on to talk and comment about that. And it's the podcast has been doing really well lately. We're just trying to give people solutions and steer people towards liberty and show that the answer to all these problems is just more liberty. So yeah, Free Mammy on the Wall podcast.
Very cool. Well, Pete, it's been great talking to you. Thanks very much. And best of luck going forward with the film.
Thanks a lot, man. I love your work, CJ. Thank you for having me on.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to the Dangerous History Podcast, and I hope that you found some value in it. If you have and you'd like to contribute to my work, there are many different ways that you can help out. One that costs you nothing but maybe a little bit of time and effort is to help spread the word about the show to anyone you think might be interested in it. There are also a bunch of ways that you can financially assist me to continue doing the work that I do and to continue making it better as best I can as time goes on. The most helpful way, and the one that gives you potentially a lot of value back in return, is to sign up for a recurring contribution via either Patreon or Subscribestar. And the links to my Patreon page and my Subscribestar page will be in the show notes of this episode. I now have multiple levels of support via either Patreon or Subscribestar. For $2 per month, you are at the Apprentice Scholar Warrior level, and you will get access to all of the vintage DHP episodes, meaning the first 52 episodes of the show, which are no longer available to the general public. And of course, you'll get the satisfaction of knowing that you're helping to keep this podcast going, and you'll have my gratitude for doing so. For only $5 per month, you will be at the Journeyman Scholar Warrior level. And for this, you'll receive the benefits of the $2 Apprentice Scholar Warrior level, plus access to special bonus DHP episodes that are available nowhere else, as well as access to ad-free regular DHP episodes as they come out, and you will be eligible to join the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors private Facebook group. For $15 per month, you will be at the Scholar Warrior level, and you'll get all the benefits of the Journeyman level, plus access to Dangerous History Lyceum course lectures as they are produced and released. And for $25 per month, you'll be at the Master Scholar Warrior level, where you will get all the benefits of the $15 Scholar Warrior level, plus additional benefits, still to be determined, but probably including but not limited to a regular live chat. You can also make one-time or recurring contributions to the Dangerous History Podcast via PayPal or Bitcoin. And another great way you can help out my work is by clicking on any of the Amazon affiliate links on my website to do your Amazon.com shopping. And if you buy stuff after going through any of those affiliate links, I get a little commission at no additional cost to you. And this helps me to buy supplies, research materials, etc., to keep making the podcast and making the podcast better. I also have an Amazon wish list of things to help me out with the Dangerous History Podcast and related productions that I put in the show notes of episodes. It's mostly research materials, but also there's some stuff in there, hardware for audiovisual production, etc. So if you want to order me something off there, that also helps out. Your support and contributions are what keeps this thing going and keeps me doing the work that I do. So I hope that you will consider helping out. This has been another episode of the Dangerous History Podcast. As always, doing my best to help you learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future.